All right, good morning, everybody. That's probably a little better, but I can even make it better still. So I had some questions. For instance, am I going to put the lectures online? And yes, I've been putting the lectures online except for this week, so you should find them. If you're having trouble finding them, maybe you're going to the wrong website. So what is the website? It's www.dr-j-gober, right? That's where the website is. And then you got a mouse to 241 and you should be able to find it, no problem. I will put this week's on. I certainly will. I don't know if I will do it today or not. Maybe. Is that like really important? Okay. I will certainly try to do that. And then guess what? Then I don't have to remember to do it later. That's really nice. Thank you. That is really good. Okay, so don't forget, we're going to meet today, and then we're going to also meet on Tuesday of next week, but not Thursday. A week from today, there's no class. A week from today is the 20th. There's no class because that's finals week already. And our final is scheduled for May 25th. That's Tuesday, and it's going to be from 10:30 until 12:30. All right, so we're going to meet an hour earlier. If you show up at 11:30, you get until 12:30 to finish up the test, and you may or may not be able to do it in an hour. I'm not sure. A lot of students get done in an hour. It's just a regular exam, all right, and it's chapters 14, 16, and 17, so we got to finish up 17. Is that right? Yeah, renal physiology. All right, so we were talking about... Well, we looked at all the structures. What's the structural and functional unit of urine formation? That is the nephron. So you got to make sure that you know everything about the nephron in terms of its structure. So if you're thinking of a nephron, what are the two main ways that you can break all the components down into? There are two categories that if you pick a structure out of a nephron, you should be able to put it in one column or another column. You want to classify by what kind of fluid is in that part of the nephron. So we call those elements. All right, what are the two kinds of elements that a nephron is made up of? That's maybe even a better way of saying it. Okay, you have vascular elements and you have tubular elements. Didn't I write this on the board? I'm sure I did. I put that on the board, right? So make sure that you can reproduce that list. Make sure you can reproduce that nephron just from memory. Okay? So today we're going to look at the interaction between these various elements to know how urine is produced. And I think we also put on the board the three processes by which urine is produced. What are the three processes? Glomerular filtration, which happens in the renal corpuscle. Right, and the renal corpuscle is made up of the glomerulus and Bowman's capsule put together. That's the first process. What's the second process? Tubular reabsorption. All right, that mostly takes place in the proximal tubules of the kidney, proximal convoluted tubule and the descending loop of Henle, and maybe even the superior parts of the descending loop of Henle. All right, that's tubular reabsorption. And then the third process is? Tubular secretion, and that pretty much happens in the distal tubule, and tubular secretion is regulated. Okay. All right, so that's a pretty good review of where we were. All right, so we're talking about glomerular filtration, and do I have a picture of glomerular filtration someplace? I guess this is a pretty good example. All right, so how is it that materials move from plasma into the filtrate in Bowman's capsule? What's making it move? Why does fluid flow from one area to another? Yeah, pressure gradient, right? So there's high pressure in the blood inside the glomerulus, there's low pressure in the filtrate, and so fluid moves out through those relatively large holes in the fenestrated capillaries of the glomerulus, and when fluid moves out, it brings small molecules with it. Like, give me some examples of small molecules that move down that pressure gradient with water when it moves. Sodium, small ions, sodium, potassium, chloride, right, magnesium, calcium, all those things. And even some larger molecules that are organic. Those, an example of that would be one that you need to stay alive because it's an important energy molecule. Glucose also gets filtered out. Other harmful compounds like urea get filtered out, and that's a good thing because it's in the filtrate, and if it stays in the filtrate, where does it end up? It ends up in urine, which is really a bad thing, for instance, if it is the water molecule, because remember, how many gallons of filtrate are produced by your kidneys every day? About 45 gallons. You dehydrate very, very quickly, right, if you didn't resorb that water later on in the nephron. Okay, but other things that you lose, maybe excess sodium, excess hydrogen ions, or excess acid, right, are filtered out. All right, so since pressure gradient from the blood in the glomerulus to pressure in Bowman's capsule determines the rate of filtration, right, as the pressure gradient increases, then more material is going to flow. The rate increases. Remember, Fick's law in terms of diffusion, when the concentration gradient increases, the rate of diffusion increases. Same thing for flow. Ah, as a matter of fact, you should know this equation. What's the equation that describes flow as it relates to pressure? You have the flow is equal to the pressure difference divided by resistance right here. Okay. Okay, so the pressure in the glomerulus determines the glomerular filtration rate, or the amount of fluid that is generated and put into the filtrate right here. All right, so how is the pressure in this capillary regulated? It's regulated by vasoconstriction or vasodilation of the afferent arteriole. So if the afferent arteriole dilates, what happens to blood flow through this capillary right here? It increases, right? And the pressure goes up, and when the pressure goes up, the filtration rate goes up, right? If the afferent arteriole constricts, what happens to blood flow through the glomerulus? It decreases, glomerular filtration rate decreases, right? So that is the one of the most important mechanisms by which the kidney adjusts glomerular filtration rate is by vasoconstriction or vasodilation of the afferent arteriole. Okay, so how is this regulated? How is glomerular filtration rate regulated? Well, we said by vasoconstriction or vasodilation, right? And that's controlled by either extrinsic mechanisms or intrinsic mechanisms. Let's break those down into just these two different ways, two different characteristics. Extrinsic means what? Where's the regulation coming from if it's extrinsic? From outside the organ. And a really good example would be the sympathetic nervous system, right? The autonomic nervous system sends nerves to the afferent arteriole, causing them to constrict. That's going to decrease glomerular filtration rate. And then there are some backup mechanisms that are just important, and these are the intrinsic mechanisms. And so sometimes we call that autoregulation, right? Because intrinsic means that the kidney can regulate itself. So in terms of the heart, what's the intrinsic mechanism by which the force of contraction is regulated by the heart itself? It doesn't require the nervous system. It's autoregulation. It's an intrinsic mechanism. And it is what? The Frank Starling law that says as the heart stretches out, as more blood fills up the heart, it gets stronger, it contracts stronger, right? And you know the mechanism because of the overlap between actin and myosin. All right, well, the kidney has sort of the same kind of thing, all right? It has intrinsic mechanisms or autoregulation. All right, so we're going to look at, I think, extrinsic first and then talk about some intrinsic mechanisms, right? But basically, how is GFR regulated? By vasoconstriction or vasodilation of the afferent arteriole, one way or another. And thus, that's going to change glomerular filtration rate. Okay, so as far as extrinsic mechanisms go, right, sympathetic activity constricts the afferent arteriole, right? That helps maintain blood pressure, and when the afferent arteriole is constricted, then blood does not go into the glomerulus. It can go to the heart and muscles and other organs in your body instead. All right, so for instance, if there is, here's a nice response loop. And what does the response loop always start with? A stimulus, and let's just say that there is a decrease in blood pressure, right? Or the stimulus could be an increase in exercise. But if there's a decrease in blood pressure, there is something that's going to monitor this right away, and that is the baroreceptors. Where are the baroreceptors located? Arch and the carotid sinus, yeah, on your neck and on the carotid sinus. All right, and then that sends information to the cardioregulatory center in the medulla oblongata, which is the which has a set point, and it can compare that information with the set point. And it says, blood pressure is decreasing, so it makes a decision. And the decision should, what, bring blood pressure back up to where it should be. So the decision would be to increase sympathetic activity, and that's what exercise does as well, initially. Not long-term, but initially, that increases your blood pressure, that stimulates the sympathetic nervous system. All right, and sympathetic nerves, of course, go to the heart. And what's the effect of sympathetic innervation on the heart? It has two effects. It has a positive inotropic effect, which means it increases force of contraction. It has a positive chronotropic effect. That means it increases the rate of contraction. All right, and so if you increase the force of contraction, stroke volume goes up. And if you increase heart rate, of course, heart rate goes up. And what is stroke volume times heart rate? Cardiac output, right? So cardiac output is directly related to stroke volume and heart rate, and if both go up, then cardiac output really goes up fast. Okay. Sympathetics, and then, of course, that's going to increase blood pressure as a result. Sympathetic nerves also vasoconstrict the afferent arterioles in the kidney, right? So what happens to blood flow through the glomerulus when these afferent arterioles constrict? It goes down. All right, so that decreases GFR, that decreases urine production, so that increases blood volume, that maintains blood volumes. And what's the effect on blood pressure if blood volume goes up? It goes up as well, okay? You can think of if you blow air into a balloon, what's happening to pressure inside that balloon? It's going up, right? All right, but also venous return increases. As blood volume increases, and when venous return increases, the heart stretches a little bit more. And what's the effect of the heart stretching a little bit more in the normal heart anyway? What happens to the contractility of the heart when you start to stretch it? When end-diastolic volume goes up, it gets stronger because of that Frank-Starling law, and thus cardiac output goes up, and then that's going to maintain blood pressure. All right. Sympathetic nerves also will vasoconstrict blood vessels in other places in your body. And so that's going to increase total peripheral resistance. And what happens to blood pressure when resistance increases? Total peripheral resistance. All right, can you remember that equation? Yeah, you should be able to derive this one, right? So what do we got? Blood pressure is equal to heart rate times stroke volume times resistance, or total peripheral resistance, right? And if any of these go up, blood pressure goes up because it's just directly related. Okay. All right, so you can see that the kidney, by regulating blood volume, helps regulate your blood pressure. And that's an extrinsic mechanism. That doesn't have anything to do with the kidney itself. All right, there are a couple different mechanisms whereby the kidney can regulate itself. And this is important because sometimes there are fluctuations in your blood pressure, and if there are fluctuations in your blood pressure, that means then that the kidney will follow that change in blood pressure and will produce more or less urine as a result. All right? But it is important in your body for urine production to be uncoupled from your blood pressure. Urine production should be controlled, and your blood pressure should be controlled, and they should be independent of each other. Blood pressure shouldn't be the determining factor for how much urine you produce. Like, what might be a good example? Maybe you drink a lot of water or something. Okay, so you should produce a lot of urine to maintain your water balance, and that should be independent of your blood pressure. Okay, so the two mechanisms responsible for this, the first one is what we call the myogenic response or myogenic constriction. And this just says that the afferent arteriole, okay, constricts when blood pressure increases. So when blood pressure increases, that's going to have a tendency to stretch the afferent arteriole, and as a response, the afferent arteriole is going to constrict back down. Okay, so and when the afferent arteriole constricts back down because of increased blood pressure, then a constant urine formation is going to be maintained. And I think we can use our equation right here on the board to understand that a little bit. All right, so let's just think of flow through the glomerulus. And if we're, so this is, so just write GFR, or think GFR for flow, and the resistance, well, I tell you what, we'll talk about that in a second. So here's GFR, and if for some reason your blood pressure increases, so if your blood pressure increases, what happens to glomerular filtration? It's going to increase, you're going to produce a lot of urine. But, right, the kidney should maintain a constant urine production. So if blood pressure increases, what should happen to resistance of the afferent arteriole? That should increase as well by what? Vasoconstriction of the afferent arteriole, that's going to maintain GFR at a constant level to make a constant urine formation. All right, so this is what's being regulated by the myogenic constriction response. There are some other mechanisms as well. We call this tubuloglomerular feedback, and that is achieved locally by chemicals that are produced on by the ascending loop of Henle that pass very, very close to the glomerulus. All right, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about this in a couple slides, tubuloglomerular feedback. All right, so here is a pretty important table, 17.1, that you should know. All right, so here are some regulation mechanisms. You've got sympathetic nerves and some autoregulation processes right here. Okay, and we want to see what the effect on glomerular filtration is. So a stimulus for sympathetic nerves, of course, that's going to be controlled by the cardioregulatory center, and the cardioregulatory center is going to get information from baroreceptors and maybe from higher centers in the brain as you perceive your circumstance and surroundings that might send what? Harmful kinds of signals, or your appreciation of harmful events around you, right, like the fight or flight response to the cardioregulatory center, that which is going to activate sympathetic outflow, and that's going to constrict the afferent arteriole, so that reduces glomerular filtration. All right, so you'll maintain fluid volume, that will maintain your blood pressure. All right, autoregulation. Right here, this is just due to blood pressure that is being applied to the kidneys, right? And if there's a decrease in blood pressure, right? So if for whatever reason, if blood pressure decreases, but if you want to maintain a constant GFR, what has to happen to resistance? If pressure decreases, so does resistance have to decrease. How do you decrease the resistance of blood flow into the glomerulus? Vasodilation. Right, and it doesn't have to dilate a lot because Poiseuille's law says that small changes in the radius of that blood vessel means massive changes in blood flow. All right, so that's a very easy way to do it. All right, or if there's an increase in blood pressure, how do you maintain a constant flow? Increased blood pressure, increasing resistance. Okay. All right, so those are the important things to remember. Okay, as far as the tubuloglomerular feedback is concerned, this is the second kind. So this is not the myogenic response. This is a different kind of response. And it is due to some chemical signals that are released by the juxtaglomerular apparatus. And we got a couple pictures of the juxtaglomerular apparatus. Maybe you can remember that from anatomy. One part of it is called the macula densa. The macula densa cells are actually cells that are in the ascending loop of Henle, the very proximal part of the distal convoluted tubule. And if there's an increased flow of filtrate, right, so if there is a lot of urine being formed, then the macula densa is going to send a signal to the afferent arteriole to constrict. All right, let me just say that one more time. If there's increased flow of filtrate, Okay, then the macula dens is going to send a signal to the afferent arteriole to constrict. So what's the effect on glomerular filtration when the macula densis sends a signal to the afferent arteriole to constrict? What happens to GFR then? It goes down, right? So increased flow of filtrate will result in what? This flow of filtrate going back down toward a set point. So that is a nice negative feedback mechanism. So hence we call that tubuloglomerular feedback, because the tube is the ascending loop of Henle, and it sends information to the afferent arteriole to regulate glomerular perfusion or blood flow through the glomerulus. All right, so that is another kind of autoregulation. And if we say autoregulation, does that mean extrinsic or intrinsic regulation? Intrinsic regulation. This happens without any nerve innervation whatsoever. Okay. All right, so let's talk some more about the nephron in terms of reabsorption of salt and water. So the amount of, let's see, where's the figure? Oh, so here we have blood coming in. 20% of the volume of the blood that enters the glomerulus leaves, gets filtered out and put in Bowman's capsule. 20%, that's a huge volume. That's why the kidney can filter 45 gallons of fluid every day, because there's a tremendous amount of fluid passing from the plasma into Bowman's capsule as a result. But don't forget, what else does it bring along with it? When that fluid moves from plasma into Bowman's capsule, it brings small molecules like glucose, sodium, and potassium, all those small molecules, right? Which are important to maintain homeostasis. But if it's left in the filtrate, right, then it will be lost from your body. Okay, so here's 45 gallons filtered. But we only produce about 1 liter of urine a day. So if we produce 180 liters of filtrate, how is it that we only produce 1 liter of urine every day? What does that mean? Then water has to move from the filtrate back into the blood. We call that process, of going from filtrate to blood. We put it on the board last time. That is what? Step number two, which is tubular reabsorption. Okay, tubular reabsorption. All right, and your body controls tubular reabsorption, right? It controls urine volume, and it varies according to the needs of the body under most circumstances. But nonetheless, right, even if you are not well hydrated, right, you still need a minimum of 400 milliliters per day urine production necessary, and that's necessary just to excrete metabolic wastes. And that's the amount that the kidneys need to make every day just to stay alive. So if you're restricted from water and can't produce that much urine, that's going to, of course, kill the kidneys, but that's also going to mess up your electrolyte balance everywhere else in the body. So this rate of excretion of water is what we call the obligatory water loss, just to maintain the health of the kidneys. Okay. All right, so let's talk about resorption, right? Because 20% of that fluid is lost in that filtration step. We need to start figuring out how to resorb that material. And resorption takes place mostly in the proximal tubule and at 100% of its capacity. It's not regulated. No fine adjustments in tubular reabsorption take place in the proximal tubule. So the mechanism is just the transport of molecules out of the filtrate back into the blood, right? Water is never transported, but other molecules are transported, for instance, sodium and glucose. And we've looked at a couple of slides of how this happens already, but hopefully I have them on the next one right here. And if you were to move a solute from the filtrate back into the blood, what would happen to the filtrate if you only take solutes out? What would happen to this filtrate? Would it become more concentrated or less concentrated? Less concentrated, okay? But in this part of the tubule, nothing is preventing osmosis, the movement of water down its concentration gradient. So as solutes move out, The water concentration increases compared to the extracellular fluid. So guess what water does? It moves down its concentration gradient from the filtrate into the extracellular space. And when water moves in this direction, then it is resorbed. So the movement of water is just a passive process. It follows the movement of these solutes right here that are actively transported. Here's a figure that I wanted to show you. Okay, so here's the mechanism for some substances in the proximal tubule, right? There's coupled transport of glucose and sodium into the cytoplasm, right? And primary active transport in the basal lateral membrane is primarily responsible for that. And the pump that is moving sodium in the basal lateral membrane as opposed to the apical membrane right here is your typical sodium potassium ATP pump. All right, so this is what kind of transport? The sodium potassium ATP pump? That's active transport, primary active transport, because it requires ATP to run. All right, and this is one of the reasons why the kidney is so highly metabolic, because it needs a lot of ATP just to run this little pump right here. Okay. All right, so what does this pump do? It pumps potassium into the cell, and it pumps sodium out of the cell, right? So sodium is high in extracellular space. So inside the cell, let's think of sodium. Is it high or low concentration inside this cell of the proximal convoluted tubule? It's low because of this pump right here. All right, so if there's low sodium and we have high sodium in the kidney tubule, the lumen of the kidney tubule, the proximal convoluted tubule, which way does sodium want to go? It wants to go in. And fortunately, here we have a co-transporter. All right, so sodium is moving down its concentration gradient. And when you have a concentration gradient, what does that really mean? If you have a gradient of electrons or something, what do you call if you have a device that has can separate electrons from one spot to another? It can generate a big gradient of electrons. What do you call that? That's a battery, right? And what can you use a battery for? As an energy source to power various devices, right? So remember, there is energy in what? A gradient. So here we have a gradient, high sodium in the filtrate, low sodium inside the cell. That's an energy source, and that can be used with this transporter right here to co-transport glucose from the filtrate in the cell. All right, and if there is energy in the sodium coming in, what can you tell me about glucose right here? Can glucose only go down its concentration gradient passively? No, right? The energy in the sodium gradient can be used to make glucose go from low concentration in the filtrate to high concentration inside the cell. All right, so what do we call that when glucose goes from low to high concentration? That's what kind of transport? Co-transport. That's sort of what I'm looking for. What I'm looking for, is it active or passive? It's active, right? Going up a concentration gradient is active. And then how would we consider this kind of active transport? Primary or secondary? It's secondary active transport, right? Which now you guys, you've been telling me, well, that's co-transport. That's good that you see that. All right, and what's the energy source that's being used if it's secondary active transport? The energy source is the gradient of sodium, right? The high in the filtrate, low inside the cell. Okay, so this co-transport is secondary active transport. I think you have to go back to, the first test or second test? I'm not sure, which maybe seems like a long time ago. Okay. All right, so that's how glucose is resorbed. As a matter of fact, almost all the glucose under normal circumstances, all the glucose under normal circumstances will be resorbed through this mechanism right here. All right, now we have high glucose inside the cell and low glucose in this interstitial fluid. So which way does glucose want to go with respect to the tubular cell and the extracellular fluid? Not the filtrate, but this extracellular fluid. If it's high inside the cell, it wants to go down its concentration gradient to the extracellular space, but remember, glucose can't move across this membrane because glucose is hydrophilic. It has all those polar hydrogen bonds on it. Can't move through the cell membrane, so it needs a transporter in the membrane to do that, And this is just a facilitated diffusion protein right here, which allows glucose to go down its concentration gradient. Okay, and then that glucose then is absorbed by this capillary right here. All right, so I do want you to know primary active transport, secondary active transport, and this maybe is an exam figure, or maybe I gave you a different one. I'm not sure which one you have in your study guide. All right, so now where does this happen? This happens in the proximal convoluted tubule. So glucose resorption, right? And what else is being resorbed right here? Sodium is being resorbed. And as sodium and glucose get resorbed, right, these are solutes, what happens to water? Water follows, right, because these are becoming very osmotic, right, so water follows along with it, so water gets resorbed as well as a result of this mechanism. Okay. All right, so salt water resorption in the proximal tubule. We have 20% of the blood volume being filtered, all right, and probably 60% gets resorbed by the proximal convoluted tubule, which means 40% is still left in the filtrate. Okay, so 65% of the sodium chloride and water is resorbed in the proximal convoluted tubule, which means what? It's returned to the blood. And those transporters are working as fast as they can the whole time, and nothing in your body can regulate that. And that's okay. Those should be working 100% of the time, to 100% of their efficiency. Right? An additional 20% of these solutes and fluid is resorbed by the descending loop of Henle, which is what? The segment that comes right after the proximal convoluted tubule. All right, so now what are we up to in terms of being resorbed? 85%. Right, of the filtered water and salt are resorbed early in the nephron tubule, proximal convoluted tubule, and the descending loop of Henle. All right, but still, you could probably dehydrate if that additional 15% of fluid is not resorbed someplace in the nephron. All right, so this part in the proximal convoluted tubule and loop of Henle is what? Constant and independent of hydration levels, and it's at a tremendous energy cost to your body to run that sodium potassium ATP pump all the time, and that costs you about 6% of your basal metabolic rate, just the kidneys, so it's a highly metabolic organ. All right, the remaining 15% of that water and salt is resorbed variably depending on the level of hydration, right? And that 15% where it is adjusted is in the proximal convoluted tubule and distal convoluted tubule and collecting duct. Right, the distal tubule and collecting duct has receptors which will be sensitive to other signals that will adjust how much fluid and salt will be reabsorbed from the filtrate. All right, so let's talk about the distal tubule and in particular the collecting duct. Right, this plays an important role in water conservation. It's impermeable to salt down in the medulla. It's only the cortical parts of the collecting duct. And the permeability of water depends on the level of antidiuretic hormone. And that's just a nice signaling molecule. So the collecting duct has to have what? What does it have to have in order to sense a level of antidiuretic hormone? It's got to have a receptor. Right. Does anybody remember where antidiuretic hormone comes from? The pituitary, as a matter of fact, the posterior pituitary gland. Okay. So, antidiuretic, and the posterior pituitary is under the control of the hypothalamus, right? So the hypothalamus has osmoreceptors for monitoring the state of hydration in our bodies. All right, so antidiuretic hormone secretion and action. The stimulus, so we're looking at table 17.3, if there's an increased osmolality in the blood that's going to your brain and your hypothalamus, which means what, are you dehydrated or overhydrated? Dehydrated, when the salt concentration increases, there are the osmoreceptors in the hypothalamus that are going to secrete antidiuretic hormone, because if you're becoming too salty inside, how would you dilute that salt out? By maintaining fluid inside your body, right? Producing less urine. All right, so under these conditions, the posterior pituitary increases the secretion of ADH, which then goes to the kidney, in particular what? The collecting duct right here, and that decreases urine volume. All right, so that means water is retained by your body. You're going to produce smaller amounts of urine that will be very salty as a result. Small urine volume that is salty. If, on the other hand, osmolality decreases, which means what? You are dehydrated or overhydrated? Overhydrated, right? So then the hypothalamus is going to tell the posterior pituitary to decrease the secretion of ADH, and when it does, then you're going to produce larger volumes of dilute urine, less salty urine, because it's going to contain more water, right? And so you're going to have water lost and increased blood osmolality as a result, because you're losing water. All right, and I'm sure you can follow the effects on blood volume right here. Okay, they follow along with osmolality. Okay, so here probably is another important exam figure, or maybe I didn't put this one on, but maybe I put the next one on. Oh, maybe I have that one on there. Okay, so let's look at this one right here. Homeostasis. Okay, of plasma concentration. So we're looking at the osmolality of plasma. And of course that goes to the brain. That's maintained by antidiuretic hormone. So ADH is secreted by the posterior pituitary in response to dehydration. And ADH is released into the blood, goes to the kidney, and once it's in the kidney, it stimulates the insertion of water channels into the plasma membranes of the cells of the collecting duct. Now, in some cells, water can't move across the membrane. The cells of the collecting duct are like that. They're impermeable to water unless, right, water channels are put into the membrane, and those water channels are what we call aquaporins, right? A porin is just a pore. Aqua has to do with water. So it's a channel that is large enough for a water molecule to move across. All right, so when ADH is high, water is drawn out of the collecting duct because the aquaporins were inserted into the cells, right, is drawn out by high osmolality of the interstitial fluid, and then it's resorbed by the blood vessels around the collecting ducts. And guess what we call those blood vessels that are around the collecting ducts? That's the vasorecta. Okay. All right, so let's look at this flow diagram right here. So if there's low water intake, you become dehydrated. You become saltier on your inside, right? Increased plasma osmolality, which is going to stimulate the osmoreceptors in the hypothalamus, which then the hypothalamus sends signals to the posterior pituitary, right? And that increases the secretion of ADH, which then, how does ADH get to the kidneys? Okay, how does the hypothalamus signal the posterior pituitary? Is there a hormone that goes from the hypothalamus to the posterior pituitary? There are hormones that go from the hypothalamus to the anterior pituitary. We call those releasing hormones. But the signal from the hypothalamus to the posterior is just via the tract, the hypothalamo-hypophyseal tract. So the nerve cell bodies in the hypothalamus have axons that go all the way through the infundibulum to the posterior pituitary, and then the axon terminus of those neurons release ADH, kind of like a neurotransmitter. But they don't affect another neuron. They're picked up by a capillary in the posterior pituitary. So ADH should be considered what? A neurohormone, because it's released by the axons from the hypothalamus. All right, but since it's a hormone, it goes to the kidney has to have a receptor, binds to the receptor, the aquaporins are inserted into the collecting duct cells, and water is resorbed. And so there's less water in the urine, okay, and so that means that blood volume is maintained because you lose less water, and you can see that subtracts from the initial stimulus. And so what kind of feedback mechanism is that? Right, that is a nice negative feedback mechanism. Okay, well, you can look at the opposite circumstance over here. That's pretty easy to follow. All right, but let's look at the exact mechanism by which those aquaporins are put into the membrane. So this is kind of a common theme that we've seen before. All right, so what are the cells that we have right here? Or what are we looking at? Well, red is what? Red is blood. Okay? And you don't have this slide? It's in your exam figures. I didn't put it into the PowerPoint. Hopefully you have your exam figures handy. Okay, here's an exam figure. Oh, I got to remember. Somebody should remind me that I need to put it in the PowerPoint upload this PowerPoint presentation into Blackboard. All right, so I'll go over this a couple times, this time and next time. All right, so bring your exam figures next time too. So red is blood, all right? And what's the name of the blood vessels around the collecting duct? Vasa recta. Okay, so here is the vasa recta cells. And then this color right here, oh, what color is that? Yellow beige? I don't know. Looks a lot darker in green. Okay. A little less light than this red right here. Okay, this is just what? Interstitial fluid. This is just fluid between the cells inside the kidney and not inside the blood. And then these are the cells of the collecting duct. Right, and it's just what? A simple cuboidal epithelium that make up that collecting duct. Now, can you picture where that collecting duct is? Can you picture a nephron? Where's the collecting duct? It's a big tube that goes to the tip of a renal pyramid, right? And a lot of distal convoluted tubules empty filtrate into the collecting duct. All right, so these are cells of the collecting duct. And then, which is blue, right? We got blue. And then over here we got yellow, which looks a lot different than this yellow to me over here. Okay. And this bright yellow just represents filtrate. Right? So this is just material that has been filtered by the glomerulus and gone through the proximal convoluted tubule, loop of Henle, distal convoluted tubule, and now finds its way into the collecting duct. All right, and this represents only the proximal part or the part of the collecting duct that's in the cortex of the kidney, not the part of the collecting duct that's down in the renal pyramids or the medulla of the kidney, just the very proximal part of the collecting duct. All right, so we got filtrate at 300 milliosmolar. That's just a measure of the solute concentration. And we have 600 milliosmolar of concentration in the interstitial fluid. All right, so the 600 milliosmolar is what? More concentrated in solute or less compared to the filtrate? Which is more concentrated in solute? The filtrate or this interstitial fluid? The interstitial fluid means it has less water compared to the filtrate. So which way does water want to go? Down its concentration gradient, but these cells are stopping it, right? And we have tight junctions between the cells. So water can't move down this concentration gradient unless there is what in this apical membrane right here? Aquaporins, right? So here is a water channel. And the amount of water channels that are put into this membrane right here is under the control of antidiuretic hormone. These water channels are built and stored in endosomes. And the endosomes are just vesicles inside the cell. Where have you seen that before? In terms of how insulin works, right? And glucose transporters, the GLUT4 transporters, are kept in endosomes until there's an insulin signal. When there's an insulin signal, then those transporters are put in the membrane so cells can take up glucose. All right, so it's the same kind of mechanisms for these aquaporins. Okay, so that's the basic mechanism. So here, let's look at the control mechanism. Here we have antidiuretic hormone. Another name for antidiuretic hormone is vasopressin. Okay, where does vasopressin come from again? Posterior pituitary, right? And it travels everywhere in the blood. ADH or vasopressin diffuses out of this capillary, out of the vasa recta. And it will bind to a surface receptor on the collecting duct cell, activating this enzyme, and it will convert ATP into cyclic AMP. So what's the first messenger? Here is a signal transduction scheme. What's the first messenger? And where do you always find the first messenger? Outside the cell, the first messenger is antidiuretic hormone. It activates adenylate cyclase. Adenylate cyclase converts ATP into cyclic AMP inside the cell, so that's the signal transduction scheme. Okay, and that cyclic AMP is a signal which is going to cause the insertion of these aquaporins that are in reserve, placed in the endosome membrane, so that when the endosome fuses with the apical surface right here, now you have additional aquapores, right, inserted into the membrane, so water can diffuse, or actually probably more appropriately, osmose down its concentration gradient into the interstitial fluid, and then finally into the concentrated solution of the blood. So water goes from filtrate to blood as a result of what kind of signal? ADH, antidiuretic hormone. All right, so I think you should be familiar with the physical chemistry of all of this, and so you should know what the second messenger signal is, cyclic AMP in this case. What's another example of a second messenger that you've learned about? Calcium can be used as a second messenger as well. It's not in this system, cyclic AMP is. Okay. Okay, and you should probably know the name of that enzyme. What's the name of the enzyme that can convert ATP to cyclic AMP? I should actually change this slide a little bit. What is the name of that enzyme? Adenylate cyclase, right? All right, so adenylate cyclase becomes activated, that produces cyclic AMP, and you should also know the name of the enzyme that's antagonistic to adenylate cyclase, because antagonism is an important mechanism for maintaining control and balance of the proper levels of cyclic AMP in a cell. We saw that in the retina. So adenylate cyclase produces cyclic AMP. What's the name of the enzyme that breaks it down? And that is called phosphodiesterase. Phosphodiesterase is the enzyme that breaks cyclic AMP down. All right, and as cyclic AMP levels decrease because the vasopressin signal decrease, cyclic AMP goes away because of phosphodiesterase activity. Guess what happens to these aquaporins? They're placed back in endosomes, right, and become inactivated as a result. So this is a relatively speedy mechanism for adjusting the rate of water reabsorption from filtrate back into the body. All right, so this happens not in the proximal tubule, but in the collecting duct. So the collecting duct can make fine adjustments in the rate of water reabsorption. What about the rate of water reabsorption in the proximal convoluted tubule? Is that adjusted? Is that regulated? That happens at a constant rate. It's not sensitive to antidiuretic hormone. Oh, I didn't read these little things over here. What does that say? Vasopressin binds to membrane protein. Ah, that's good. All right? Receptor activated cyclic AMP second messenger system via adenylate cyclase activation. 3, yeah, these aquaporins and endosomes are inserted into the membrane. And 4, water is absorbed by osmosis into the blood. That's exactly what we talked about. Okay. So that's a really handy slide, all right, because it gives you a nice picture of what we've been talking about. Okay, so renal clearance or the excretion. What is excretion going to be equal to? Okay, so secretion is the opposite of reabsorption. So the three processes for producing urine would be filtration in the glomerulus, resorption. Where does resorption happen at a constant rate, and the majority of it happens? About 80% of reabsorption of solutes and water happen in what part of the nephron? The proximal tubule and that first bit of the descending loop of Henle. Okay, secretion takes place pretty much throughout the whole nephron. Okay, so secretion is opposite in the direction to that which occurs for reabsorption. Right, reabsorption decreases renal clearance. Right, if we remove stuff from the filtrate, that decreases clearance. Secretion, on the other hand, does what? Increases renal clearance. Okay, because we're putting stuff into the filtrate. So the excretion rate is equal to filtration plus secretion. That is how we're filling this filtrate up, minus the reabsorption rate. That's how we define renal clearance. Okay, so not all blood delivered to the glomerulus is filtered into the glomerular capsule. Only 20% is filtered, right? The remainder passes into the efferent arteriole and then back into the circulation after it passes through the peritubular capillaries, right? But substances that aren't filtered still can be cleared by active transport into the tubules, right? And we call that process secretion. Some examples of this, some small molecules that can be filtered but you don't want to lose would be glucose and amino acids. Those should all be resorbed from the filtrate so you don't lose those important molecules. So filtered glucose and amino acids are normally 100% resorbed from the filtrate. And we saw the mechanism by which glucose is resorbed, right, via co-transport and using the sodium gradient to get it through the apical membrane. And since it's a transporter, it's a protein, those protein molecules display saturation. So if there is super high levels of glucose in the filtrate, then all the transporters will be occupied transporting glucose, and some of the glucose will be left in the filtrate as a result of that, if it is saturated. Right? The level needed to saturate all the glucose transporters is achieved at the maximum transport rate, and we call that the transport maximum. Talked about this already. So glucose and amino acids, right, months ago, we talked about the transport maximum is when the rate of transport of a solute reaches a maximum. So if you further increase the glucose concentration, it cannot get resorbed. Right, but glucose and amino acid transporters don't saturate under normal conditions. Right, so if your body is maintaining plasma glucose concentrations through homeostatic mechanisms, then the transport maximum is never reached in the kidney. And if the transport maximum is never reached or exceeded, then you don't lose any glucose in the urine. Right? Now, what is the condition in which these transporters are saturated and you start to lose glucose in urine? That we call that diabetes mellitus, right? Okay, but it's not just glucose, it's for amino acids as well. All right, so when you have urine with glucose in it, we call that glycosuria, right? So that's just presence of glucose in the urine. The transport maximum occurs when glucose is around 200 milligrams per 100 ml or 200 milligrams per deciliter. All the transporters are saturated with glucose, which then that means that glucose, not all the glucose will be reabsorbed. We call that the renal plasma threshold. Right? And if that threshold is exceeded, then glucose ends up in the urine. Right? And glucose is normally absent in the urine because plasma levels stay below this value. So in a normal person, why is it that glucose stays below 180 milliliters per deciliter in the blood? Because a normal person can secrete insulin. Insulin then inserts those GLUT4 transporters in muscle cells and other kinds of cells, so glucose leaves the plasma and enters cells. So that lowers plasma glucose levels and keeps it down below 180 milligrams per deciliter, even though you might be in a fed state or you've been eating a lot of glucose. Okay. So hyperglycemia has to exceed that renal plasma threshold before glycosuria takes place. And that's in normal circumstances, but patients with diabetes mellitus, right, routinely can exceed that renal threshold, right, if they don't monitor their blood and treat themselves with insulin, for instance, maybe after a meal, that will result in glycosuria as a result of that. Okay, so that's one important mechanism. Let's look in terms of electrolytes and acid-base balance as well. Okay, so what are some important electrolytes? Sodium, potassium. What are sodium, potassium? Tell me something about sodium, potassium. What are they involved with? Sodium, potassium pump. Which is going to control various things like glucose transport, right? Because you need sodium gradients for glucose transport in the kidney, but in terms of electrophysiology, what is sodium and potassium important for? Development of the resting membrane potential and also action potentials. Remember, what's the first part of an action potential? Depolarization, which is sodium rushing in the cell. That's followed by repolarization, potassium leaving the cell. Right, so the basic electrophysiology is controlled by these electrolytes as well. All right, and then remember there's an interrelationship between hydrogen ion and bicarbonate ion. How are these related? What's the enzyme that relates these compounds right here? The carbonic anhydrase reaction, right? When your body produces CO2. And chloride is very important for maintaining electrical neutrality when these other cations are moved across membranes. And what is inorganic phosphate important for? ATP production, right? You need inorganic phosphate to take an ADP and make an ATP out of it. And phosphate is also important for bones, bone strength, right? Making hydroxyapatite. Okay. And phosphorylating enzymes or dephosphorylating enzymes is an important regulatory mechanism. When you have, what are the enzymes that can phosphorylate or dephosphorylate enzymes to turn them on and off to help regulate metabolism? What do we call those? Those are either, which is the one that can phosphorylate an enzyme? What's that called? A kinase, yeah. And what is the kind that dephosphorylates an enzyme? A phosphatase, right? So, of course, that's really important whether you're going to promote or inhibit, what, glycogenolysis? Right, for instance, those are important enzymes, which then control blood glucose levels. All right, so what you can begin to see is the interrelationship between all of these different enzymes and systems, and what do you call that when all of these different levels and enzymatic processes are constantly changing and readjusting themselves depending on changes in your internal environment? What do we call that dance of all these enzymes and compounds and blood pressure? That's homeostasis, right? That's kind of an advanced concept, so I think maybe now you're beginning to see how these things are interrelated to each other. Okay. So, of course, control of plasma sodium is important for regulation of blood volume, and hence blood pressure, and, of course, the electrophysiology as well. And control of plasma potassium is important for proper function of anything that is controlled by action potentials. Right, including all muscles as well as nerve conduction as well. All right, so the kidneys play important roles for maintaining all of that. An important hormone that maintains sodium and potassium in balance is aldosterone. All right, so and aldosterone works on the kidney. Okay, so we lose a lot of sodium and potassium by filtration. Right. Most of it is resorbed, 90% that is filtered is resorbed, right, before the distal tubule, which means what? The proximal convoluted tubule, right? The remaining 10% is resorbed variably in the distal tubule and collecting duct according to the needs of the body and how much you're ingesting of these particular kinds of compounds. And so aldosterone does not have effect on the proximal tubule. It has its effect on the distal tubules of the nephron, the distal convoluted tubule and the collecting duct. Right? Aldosterone controls the secretion of potassium and the resorption of sodium. So what can you tell me about the effects of aldosterone on the direction of potassium movement and sodium movement? I think I've mentioned this before a long time ago. What's the direction of potassium and sodium? Are they both going to move in the same direction? Or are they going to move in opposite directions? Opposite directions. And I think you should have a basic understanding of why that is. What's the basic mechanism in all membranes that moves potassium in one direction and sodium the opposite direction? And in particular, diffusion, yeah, it's going to be an active process. And in particular, it's always going to be moving sodium which direction? Sodium, and from outside the cell to inside or inside the cell to the outside? From inside to outside. All right, and what about potassium? We said it's what? It's going to be opposite to that. So which way does potassium move? From outside to inside, right? So in a normal disease-free state, where do you have high sodium? Outside the cell, where do you have high potassium? Inside the cell. And what's really responsible for that? What is the primary active transporter for that? The sodium-potassium ATP pump. All right, which is something you knew way months and months and months ago, okay? Which is, again, the basic reason why aldosterone, right, controls potassium secretion and sodium resorption. Because why? The sodium-potassium pump works in, well, it's an antiporter, right? It's an antiporter, okay. So in the absence of aldosterone, 80% of the remaining sodium is resorbed by the distal tubule and cortical collecting duct. That's in the absence of aldosterone. But when aldosterone is high, all the remaining sodium is resorbed in that part of the nephron. Right? So aldosterone does what? It promotes sodium resorption, but at what expense? Potassium secretion. Right, so sodium and potassium will move in opposite directions. And what's the basic underlying fundamental principle of why that is? It is the sodium-potassium ATP pump. All right, so now we have to look at that sodium-potassium ATP pump a little bit to know how that happens. Okay, so potassium control is very important. All right, and potassium is filtered, and about 100% of it is resorbed by this proximal tubule right here. Right, so there is virtually zero concentration of potassium in the loop of Henle, right, and the proximal convoluted tubule. But if your body needs to get rid of it because it's too high, then it is secreted back into this cortical portion of the collecting duct and distal convoluted tubule. Right, so potassium almost is completely resorbed in the proximal tubule. Under aldosterone stimulation, right, potassium is secreted into the cortical collecting duct. But if potassium is being secreted, what can you tell me about sodium? Aldosterone promotes secretion of potassium, but what for sodium? Remember, it goes the opposite way. What's opposite of secretion? Reabsorption. Okay, so anytime you see secretion of potassium, just think also resorption of sodium. And what's the basic underlying principle for that again is? The sodium-potassium ATP pump. And, oh, what does that require? ATP, right. All potassium in urine from secretion rather than filtration, right? Because the amount of potassium that is filtered is resorbed in this proximal tubule, and if there's any left over in the urine, it is due to secretion in the distal tubule. Okay. All right, so here we got our whole nephron once again. All right, so tell me the structures as I hover over them. What is this right here? Bowman's capsule, right? And then we got the glomerulus. Here we've got afferent arteriole, so blood is coming into the glomerulus. What kind of capillaries is glomerulus right here? It's fenestrated. It's very leaky, right? So 20% of the plasma leaks out into Bowman's capsule. 80% of the blood remains and gets transported. It flows into the efferent arteriole. All right, so now we got filtrate right here. It moves into the proximal convoluted tubule, right? The descending loop, ascending loop of Henle. And then that empties filtrate into, what is this little squiggly segment right here? This is the distal convoluted tubule. And now notice where this distal convoluted tubule goes. Right between the afferent arteriole and the efferent arteriole in all of these nephrons. All right, it passes right between them. And so there's important communication between blood flow and filtrate flow in this area right here, and this is what we call the juxtaglomerular apparatus. All right, so the juxtaglomerular apparatus means that it is made up of the afferent arteriole, the efferent arteriole, the distal convoluted tubule, right, and all the smooth muscles that can control vasoconstriction and vasodilation of these blood vessels right here. All right, but since the distal convoluted tubule passes very close to these arterioles right here, there is some additional specialization in the cells that make up the juxtaglomerular apparatus. Now, this might be a little review from anatomy. Okay, hopefully it's not too boring. But these cells, what do we call these cells? These that are in the interstitial area right here, these are what we call the granular cells. These specialized cells that make up the distal convoluted tubule, these are the macula densa cells, and these are the mesangial cells right here. Right? These granular cells secrete renin. Where have you heard renin before? In the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism. Okay. These macula densa cells secrete compounds important for tubular glomerular feedback. And I'm not sure we can characterize what those compounds are very well at this point in time, but it might actually be adenosine, right, which can signal contraction or relaxation of the circular smooth muscles of the afferent arteriole right here. And we have really no clue what these mesangial cells are doing in the juxtaglomerular apparatus really at this time. Right, but you might want to be able to label those, right? Granular cells, macula densa cells, and then the mesangial cells right here. Maybe. They have the juxtaglomerular apparatus. All right, so now you kind of know where that juxtaglomerular apparatus is. All right, the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism is activated by release of renin from what cells? These granular cells right here. And when do these granular cells release renin? All right, when there is decreased blood pressure. Right, renin converts, remember, angiotensinogen, that's an inactive form of angiotensin, into angiotensin 1, which still is not very potent. And then angiotensin 1 is what? Converted into angiotensin 2 by angiotensin-converting enzyme, or ACE, in the lungs, right? And then angiotensin 2 stimulates the release of aldosterone. From where? Where does aldosterone come from? Was this on the last test? Or is it for this one? Oh, it's for this one too. That shows you how important this mechanism is, right? So go back and maybe review that figure. All right, and so aldosterone, renin is an enzyme. These are hormones. ACE is an enzyme. Aldosterone is a hormone, so it's in the blood and it goes to the... I tell you what, where is aldosterone released from? The adrenal cortex, right? It's a mineralocorticoid, so it's going to help adjust the concentrations of minerals in your body. Like what two minerals? Sodium and potassium. Sodium and potassium, so therefore we call that a mineralocorticoid, not a glucocorticoid. A glucocorticoid is going to regulate glucose levels, right? But mineralocorticoids regulate levels of minerals like sodium and potassium. Okay. So an inadequate intake of NaCl always causes a decreased blood volume, okay, because lower osmolality inhibits antidiuretic hormone, causing less water reabsorption. Right, so antidiuretic hormone is going to have the opposite effect of a diuretic, right? So that causes less water reabsorption. All right, low blood volume and renal blood flow stimulate release of renin. Low blood volume and renal blood flow. When blood volume is decreased, right, that decreases blood flow and blood pressure decreases, so those granular cells are going to release renin. All right, this is via the direct effects of blood pressure on the granular cells and also to some degree by sympathetic activity, initiated by that arterial baroreceptor reflex when blood pressure is low. So renin is released. All right, so here is this one of our last folks? No, not our last one. Good. Okay, so we have low sodium intake. All right, so let's look at a nice feedback loop, which is going to incorporate antidiuretic hormone as well as the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism. So this is a particularly important flow diagram. So since it's a response loop, it always starts with a stimulus, which is low sodium intake. We're going to have low plasma sodium concentration that goes to the hypothalamus. So what's going to stimulate the hypothalamus right here? High osmolality or low osmolality? Low osmolality, right? Low osmolality, low sodium, right? That's going to go to the posterior pituitary, or the hypothalamus is going to then release less antidiuretic hormone. So what's going to happen to urine formation if ADH decreases? Okay. Water reabsorption in that decreases water reabsorption in the collecting ducts, because remember, ADH puts those aquaporins in the collecting ducts, so water will be reabsorbed, right? It will be an antidiuretic, but if that ADH goes away, then a diuretic effect takes place. Water will not be reabsorbed, so it's going to stay in the filtrate. That's going to increase urine volume. That will decrease blood volume. All right, when you decrease blood volume, what's happening to blood pressure? It goes down. All right, and when blood pressure goes down, that's going to stimulate the baroreceptors, which will increase sympathetic nerve activity, for instance, to bring blood pressure back up. But also, low blood volume will stimulate the juxtaglomerular apparatus. And that, when the juxtaglomerular apparatus, in particular the granular cells, they're going to release renin. That's going to produce angiotensin 1, then angiotensin 2, right? Angiotensin 2 will go to the adrenal cortex, causing the release of aldosterone. Aldosterone is going to go to the collecting duct to increase sodium resorption. So which way is sodium moving if it's being resorbed in the collecting duct? It's going from filtrate to blood. It's going to be put back in the blood from the filtrate. So that's going to help somebody retain sodium in their body, so increase sodium retention. And how does that correspond to the initial stimulus? It's going to subtract from it, so this is a nice negative feedback mechanism maintaining sodium homeostasis in the body. Okay. So next time I want to start with this figure right here, which shows in better detail. So this, again, you might not have in your PowerPoints, but it is an exam figure. All right, so bring the ADH as well as this aldosterone figure in next time. So we're going to start here next time. But I have a couple questions. I guess I can ask you a couple questions right before you leave. Who's got the sign-in sheet? You're going to bring that down? All right, what kind of hormone is aldosterone? Is it hydrophilic or hydrophobic? Aldosterone. It's hydrophobic because it's a steroid hormone. It's a steroid hormone. Where do the receptors for steroid hormones have to be? Can they be on the cell surface? They have to be inside the cell, right? Because steroids can enter the cell. They can go through the plasma membrane. What is the mode of action for steroid hormones? Since they can actually go right inside the cell, they can act as transcription factors. Hopefully this maybe comes back to you a little bit. So look at this slide, review some of that stuff, review your physical chemistry so that this slide makes easy sense next week. Okay? All right, and when is your final? It's a week from Tuesday. Yeah, it's a week from Tuesday. It's a week after our last lecture. Okay.